Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business for Tuesday the 27th of March 2007, with thanks to our sponsor CyberTrust. I've had a massive couple of weeks travelling from Brisbane to the Sunshine Coast, CBIT in Germany, and then a well-earned break in Istanbul, Turkey. I got back on Sunday, and let me tell you, after a 40-hour trip stuffed into an aluminium tube with a few hundred other people, I feel fantastic. No sleep, you know. That croak you can hear in my voice is the sound of pure joy, not the mysterious virus that I managed to pick up on the plane. But moving on, we've got a great show today. We've got some first-run news here on Risky Business this week. Metasploit 3.0 is out. For those of you who don't know what Metasploit is, it's a very popular tool used by security researchers and penetration testers. Assurance.com.au's Adam Poynton will explain it soon when he joins us on the line from Melbourne. We'll also check in with McLennan Starkey at Ossert, and boy, has he got the lowdown on probably the funniest and cleverest scam we've seen in a long time. He'll be along soon, as will Andrew Walls from CyberTrust, who'll be joining us to chat about vulnerability disclosure and the ethics thereof. Hey, we know it's a topic that's been done to death, but it's shifting territory, so it's always worth having a look every now and then. But of course, first up, it's time for the news headlines with ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria. And Munir, it looks like legislation which is designed to introduce the government's fabled access card is going to be introduced in June.
It is indeed. I mean, this is such a huge step. I mean, finally, we've got the Human Services Minister here saying that, you know, the legislation is now going to be presented as one package, and this will mean members of the public can see the full detail of the legislation. Well, about time, I say.
Yeah, I wonder if it's going to include technical details of the implementation.
Well, I mean, anything would be good right now. I mean, so far we don't really know too much about it. I remember speaking to the AFP commissioner, or hearing speak actually, Mick Kilty, and he was talking about this, saying there's still a temptation for the private sector to use the access card in a de facto way, you know, as identity. So they've, like, if we've got the commissioner of the AFP saying that kind of thing, they have an awful lot to tell us still. But I got to say, I mean, I'm not that confident that we will get the full specs.
No, look, I had similar admissions from the Australian Federal Police in an article I wrote for you guys over a year ago, and they were saying, look, you know, there's nothing wrong with it being used as a de facto sort of, you know, authentication standard. Well, I don't think they were actually casting judgments on it quite like that, but they did say that there was nothing really in there to prevent the private sector using the card as a de facto for authenticating people. Now, I guess moving on to what's undoubtedly going to be one of the biggest stories in IT over the next couple of years, it seems, you know, the IT industry isn't the IT industry unless we've got some large profile lawsuit going on.
Yeah, that's true.
Oracle taking on SAP. I mean, it's the new IBM versus SCO. We're kind of sick of that one, and we've wheeled out a new one. But this one actually has a bit of a security element.
A bit. This is pretty much the ultimate security story here. You know, we've got corporate espionage here. It's Oracle saying SAP actually broke in and stole some of its intellectual property. It's the kind of story which you never usually hear about, because it's usually covered up or hidden away, or, you know, dealt with out of court, and there's lots of very, very red faces. Here, they're going to be in court. Got to say, I'm hoping that we get some details here, because, you know, from the actual story itself, Oracle said that around last November it noticed a lot of unusually heavy volume of download activity in its password protected customer support area. That was, you know, information for PeopleSoft and JD Edwards customers. It's one definitely to keep our eyes on.
Well, I think, you know, from what I've been reading in various airport lounges for the last couple of days, it looks like, you know, SAP acquired this company Tomorrow Now in the US, which is used, they offer support for Oracle products, some of the products that they got through acquisition, like the JD Edwards stuff. And they actually charge around half of what Oracle charges to support their own products. And of course, it's a very nifty way for them to get those customers and to try to sell them SAP products. And it looks like the biggest concern to Oracle, you know, according to their statement of claim, is that a lot of support materials were actually downloaded from a customer portal as well as software. I mean, we're not talking about source code here. We're talking about software. But certainly this is one definitely to keep an eye on. Now, we've got probably one of the sillier scams that we've seen in a while, which is Microsoft denying that there was a breach of their security in their Xbox servers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I read the story and I thought, okay, they're denying it. Is this really a huge deal? What if people break into the Xbox Live side, what information are they actually going to get? I don't quite understand what a big deal this is. Can you explain that to me?
Well, apparently they were using compromised accounts. It looks like they got the credentials through some sort of phishing scam.
Right.
And they're using the credentials to buy online gaming credits. And it's like, I'm thinking, how can you do that and not actually get caught? I mean, you know, I think the people who did this must have been assuming that no one would really notice, but it looks like they have noticed, and I really can't imagine that they won't get done for this. It just seems one of those really dumb crimes.
Like, it's totally true. I mean, you know, there's no point stealing something if you can't get away with it. You're going to get done for actually doing it. And that's the way the online side works. I've got to point out that this actual statement that came from Microsoft really made me laugh. And it said, you know, there are a few isolated incidents where malicious users have been attempting to draw personal information from unsuspecting users. I think that terminology is really very funny.
Unsuspecting. Well, they're being quite sensitive towards the unsuspecting users. Victims, aka sort of not, you know, they're not the sharpest tools in the shed. So I think that might be the other way of saying it. But and we've got another social attack, which is, you know, big surprise, with a Trojan horse targeting Skype users.
Yeah, this is one that's come up a little while ago as well, wasn't it? I mean, I've got to say, I'm surprised there isn't more of this. The Skype users have been getting a little bit of this. There was one, I think it was about a month or 2 months ago. But people who've been using MSN or ICQ or those kind of things have been getting these links for, you know, these spammed links that lead to malicious pages and malicious files for many, many years now. So I think it's the Skype community actually going to have to wake up to this, because it's bound to, you know, there's bound to be more incidents like this.
Look, Minnie, I think I'm going to have some T-shirts made which say, don't click that link. Because really, I mean, when you look at 90% of the malicious code, the malware out there, it's always some, you know, grandma or something clicking on a link in an email. And, you know, we've really got to do something about this, don't we?
Well, you know, I mean, we talk about grandma. It's not just grandma. There was that incident just a short time ago about the John Howard heart attack. I mean, how many people got done on that one?
Well, again, it might have been a case of wishful thinking for a lot of people, mate. What? But, double click?
But, you know, that came on an email. If that had been sent by Instant Messenger, I just thought probably more people. In fact, you know, if you get a message from your Instant Messenger client, then usually it's from one of the people you trust. And that obviously increases the chances that you're going to click on it if you think your mate is sending you this link. On this one, it's about Skype users, but if it was about the John Howard email, let's just say that was turned around, I think a lot more people would have been caught by this one. So,
well, yeah, there is that inherent trust model built into Instant Messenger applications, isn't it, where you're only really communicating with people you've had some sort of prior relationship with.
It's true. And so it seems that, you know, I would have, that's why I'm definitely surprised that there aren't more attacks coming by Instant Messenger. But it's one of the things that all of the security companies, the antivirus companies, have been telling us for a while, that they expect this to be a major vector of attack and a growing one. And so far, I mean, this is just evidence that they've probably right on the ball there.
Munir, thanks a lot for joining us again. Welcome back.
It's been a pleasure. Cheers.
Each week, we check in with an AusCert staffer to find out what's been happening in their neck of the woods. And this week we're joined again by McLennan Starkey, Macca, who has the skinny on a somewhat ingenious scam. It's Phishing with a Difference. Macca, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us about this low-tech scam of yours?
One of our members reported to us early last week that a number of their staff members had received CD-ROMs. On the CD-ROMs, when they attempted to place them into the drive, a Windows Media Player installation executable was started, but in the background, a keylogger was actually dropped. Now, this is a very, very interesting vector, because most of the time, what we see is users that are getting an email will be asked to browse somewhere else, at which point a keylogger will be installed onto a vulnerable machine. This is a very low-tech scam, but it's also a very good one.
Well, it would bypass a lot of controls that organisations have in place to prevent keyloggers getting onto their machines, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, it would. The vector doesn't come in from the internet, and from what I understand of most organisations, nobody really has a policy in place to cater for this kind of attack.
Now, you say it automatically drops this thing. Is that based on some sort of local vulnerability, or how does that work?
No, it's actually based on the fact that most users will run as an administrator. Really. When a user double clicks or the file auto runs, the CD auto runs, the Windows Media installation will be started, and in the background, the keylogger will be dropped. Because most users have administrative access to their machines, even in corporate networks today, it will usually be dropped straight to the Windows System 32 directory and start up from there.
And how are these CD-ROMs actually arriving? Are they arriving as marketing material? Or, I mean, you know, what would actually compel someone to take it out of the envelope and stick it in the drive?
As far as I'm aware, it's actually addressed to the user.
And we understand some more malicious Word files are doing the rounds.
Yes, Office documents are a favourite for miscreants. Most people who receive an Office document that is addressed to them and may contain interesting information, they're likely to read it. Due to the raft of vulnerabilities that we've had recently in the Microsoft Office product, it's an extremely good way of getting a user to open a malicious Word document, which will then drop some kind of malicious code on your machine.
So it seems that it's still a favourite. I mean, we've been hearing a lot about Word. I mean, listeners to this program will know that it's been a recurring theme for the last few weeks.
Users should always check, even if they receive a document that comes from internal that asks them to open it immediately. They should check with the sender and say, hey, did you guys send this to me? Is this something that I should really be opening? If you're not expecting it, it's a good idea to check with the sender to see if they really did send you something.
Okay, well, McLennan Starkey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was AusCert's McLennan Starkey on the line from Brisbane. We're headed south now to chat to Adam Poynton in Melbourne. He's a partner with assurance.com.au, a small company specialising in penetration testing. He's also got a few high-profile vulnerabilities under his belt, including an absolute doozy he found in Cisco products last year. Now, I mentioned at the top of the program that Metasploit version 3.0 has just been released. And I mean just. I was chatting with the program's creator, H.D. Moore, earlier today over IM. And unfortunately, he's too busy writing the release notes for version 3.0 to chat to us. That's right, 3.0 is available for download, but Moore is still writing the release notes and documentation. It is fresh. So, in lieu of having Moore on the program, we thought we'd do the next best thing and invite Adam on the show. He's a user of Metasploit and can give us a rundown on what the program is and why a new release is important. Adam, thanks a lot for taking some time out to talk to us.
No problem.
So, for listeners who don't actually know what Metasploit is, can you tell us roughly what it is?
Essentially, Metasploit is a framework for exploit development and penetration testers to more easily and more effectively assess networks and software for vulnerabilities. So it allows them to more quickly develop exploit code and more reliable exploit code and reuse what they've already developed or has been provided with Metasploit with the framework in writing other vulnerability attack tools, actually.
It was quite controversial when it was first released, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, because people saw it as a bit of a point-and-click way to, you know, exploit hosts. But it's not exactly that. It's more of a tool for researchers and for security software vendors to test their products against known exploit code that's out in the wild. So it has, you know, like every security tool, it's a double-edged sword. Attackers can use it, but also vendors or people in defense of networks can use it to better detect exploit code that's out there.
Well, it's actually become very important, hasn't it? I mean, it's become sort of like Nmap in that it's difficult to imagine a time before it.
Very much so. I mean, it's clear that exploit development and people developing code out there and malicious code are skilled and do have such tools in their own kits. So this is just raising the bar and making it more available to other people such that the vendors really do get off their butts and better protect customers from attacks like those provided or more easily developed with the Metasploit framework.
So what sort of things would you use it for in both penetration testing and vulnerability research?
Well, we use it in pen testing a fair bit once we've sort of scoped the area if there is a relevant bug. We also do a lot of in-house development of our own modules for Metasploit because the framework's not just a big pile of exploits. It is a framework that you can easily hook into and use more of the underlying code that allows you to just write exploits or test for vulnerabilities quicker and more reliable. So we find that usually when we are doing a pen test, we'll come across bugs that are either known or we don't have our own code for them, and rather than just going through other people's code and working out exactly what's happening, if we know how the vulnerability works, then we can quickly write a check or an exploit for it using the Metasploit framework which is reliable, and we can just reuse it and reuse it again on the next test or other tests.
Now, I spoke to HD Moore, who is the creator of Metasploit today, and I actually asked him how it pays him, and he said about minus $5,000. And if you count the conferences that are yet to reimburse him, about another $3,000 on that. And he actually says, I asked him why on earth he does it, and he says, it's fun, it's my hobby. To which I replied, I like to sit around pinching myself until I bleed while smoking cigarettes rolled out of $100 bills, because it seems to be about as much fun to someone like me. But he's really into this stuff, and he's added a bunch of features which haven't been documented yet, but he's got an SQL injection framework, web application features, he's added more fuzzers, and he's doing Windows 802.11 Wi-Fi injection stuff.
True.
So how much do you think the added features in Metasploit, in the Metasploit framework, are actually going to stimulate innovation and new research in the coming months?
I think quite greatly, really, because it is fairly extensible and it's very easy to hook into and reuse, as well as extend what is there. As people are finding sort of higher or other layer bugs, like you mentioned, the added to 11 issues, because the Metasploit framework is basically paving the way to more easily fuzz some of the 802.11 implementations out there. I think as far as vulnerability research on new systems, hand-in-hand with the Metasploit framework, it definitely will have a positive effect in squashing those bugs that exist, and perhaps only the black hats know.
So for users out there who don't know what a fuzzer is...
It's essentially a semi-automated way of putting every combination and permutation of input through to a system or a process, sort of thrashes it out for every way or every which way it handles that input. It's a good way for black box testing when you don't have the source code for the application you're assessing, so therefore can't pick through it manually. You need to basically throw the kitchen sink at it and see what happens in each way.
So really, you know, far from being something which is, you know, a tool for the bad guys, it seems that the good guys are getting, you know, a great deal of use out of this and really using it to find vulnerabilities, to better test systems. It's not the evil black hat tool that everyone thought it was when it first came along a couple of years ago.
No, not at all. I mean, the reality is exploit development and exploitation of software is fairly underground when it comes to zero-day bugs and things like that. And the Metasploit framework helps legitimate users and assessors and vendors and people giving their clients, should they be performing pen tests, better overall coverage and protection and assessment of their network. So whereas reliable, high-quality, zero-day bugs used to be in the hands of black hats, now newly released bugs and reliable exploit code is now in the hands of the assessment teams that probably wouldn't be getting those bugs otherwise.
Okay, Adam, I understand you're very busy today, so thanks for taking time out on such short notice to speak to Risky Business.
No problem.
Assurance.com.au's Adam Poynton. You're listening to Risky Business on itradio.com.au. I'm Patrick Gray. As regular listeners know, we're sponsored by Cybertrust. The show simply wouldn't be possible without their financial support. So each week, we like to have a Cybertrust staffer on the show to discuss an issue of the week. Today we're talking to Andrew Walls about vulnerability disclosure. Andrew Walls, thank you very much for joining us here on Risky Business.
It's a pleasure as always, Patrick.
Now, we saw some comments coming out of the United States in regard to bug disclosure. Now, this is, you know, a favourite topic among security professionals. Window Snyder, ex-Microsoft, actually. Can you imagine that? Someone called Window working for Microsoft. Window Snyder, who now works for Mozilla, has said that software publishers are essentially at the mercy of bug researchers.
I would have to agree with them, to tell the truth. I sort of feel like once a product is out there in the world, what happens to it is outside the control of the producer. People will find flaws with it. People will find unknown benefits in it and will trumpet both to the media. So if it's outside your control, if you've published it, well, you just have to learn how to manage what comes out. You can't spin it. You can't control what's going to happen. You have to control what you can, which is your reaction to it and the reaction of your customers to the news once it hits.
But I mean, it's a frequently debated topic, and I mean, there's been a number of companies that have attempted to introduce sort of vulnerability disclosure guidelines for people in dealing with them. But at the end of the day, I mean, it really is a case that if someone's found a bug, it's really up to them what they do with it. And is there anything that can actually be done about this? I don't know. I suppose for the software publishers, you'd call it a problem.
Well, it depends. There's a bunch of different variables at play here. Obviously, there's a straight profitability issue that nobody wants a problem in their software or hardware to be bandied about in the press or on the chat rooms or anything, because it hurts your sales. There's also the issue that if this is a true security exposure, that broadcasting it may mean that people will publish exploits and will exploit the vulnerability that they might not have done that if it were not public information. At the same time, on the flip side of that, people will not protect themselves unless they know that they need to protect themselves. And so if we do not discuss these vulnerabilities with the appropriate people out there in the world, how will they know to build the security controls? How will they know to patch their firewalls? And so forth and so on. So there's pluses and minuses on both sides of the equation. So it's very difficult to say, for example, we should only disclose vulnerabilities and bugs to responsible parties. Well, responsible in whose world? Responsible for what? I don't think we can exert that kind of control and really expect to see good results from it.
Well, I mean, some people are definitely not into what's termed, you know, quote unquote, responsible disclosure. A guy who's made quite a name for himself for just really not caring about what software vendors or publishers have to say is Dave Itell. Mm. And he said of Mozilla's comments, responsible disclosure is a marketing term. Responsible disclosure plays into the hands of Microsoft and other big vendors. They are trying to control the process. Now, a lot of people really don't like Dave Itell's approach, especially software publishers, because he has a habit of releasing exploit code to zero-day vulnerabilities to his clients without even bothering to notify vendors. But he makes a pretty solid point, doesn't he?
Although I may not agree with everything that he says, I understand the logic behind what he says, and I think it's a cogent case that he puts. At the end of the day, a vulnerability is a representation of a flaw of some form. It may not have been anticipated. The vendor may not have been capable of anticipating the vulnerability. But at the end of the day, it's still a flaw. If it were a car, they'd issue a recall. I'd get a letter from my dealer being told to come in and get the steering bolts repaired or whatever. The vendors of software do the same thing. They issue patches, they issue updates, they issue warnings. Whether people are talking about these bugs, flaws, features in public or in private is really irrelevant. The issue is how do we manage our reaction to it? How do we basically partner to whatever extent possible with our customers to make sure they can react to it in a safe, secure manner.
I think another interesting thing worth noting here is that it's not always your independent sort of hacker types who are, disclosing stuff in a way that can be seen as irresponsible. I remember there was a huge controversy when ISS, Internet Security Systems, now owned by IBM, published, a lot of details on a bug in Sendmail without actually or it was Apache. It was one of the two. I think it may have been Apache, without actually notifying the open source collective that maintained the code repository. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you think we're ever going to arrive at that nirvana when the rules of disclosure, the rules of engagement, I suppose, between people who find bugs and people who run software companies are actually really well defined?
As long as we have competitive interests in the market, no, we won't reach there. Because the reality is that some companies will benefit from disclosures of bugs in their competition systems. And I'm not implying in any way that ISS was playing that game.
Well, Apache Foundation is clearly not a competitor. So.
Right. So there's always going to be inducements, if you will, how was it put by Napoleon? Never interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. The same thing will play out in the market.
Andrew Walls, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Patrick.
That's it for Risky Business number 6, thanks to CyberTrust and our hosting partner Vigabyte. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday with more news and analysis. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with Risky Business, email me at patrick@dotbob.net. And I'll spell that out for you. It's patrick at dotbob.net. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.